I want to move now up to the northern area. And instead of giving us a tour of the country, I want to give us a tour of the psyche. And I'm going to do this by way of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Around 100 BC, a road is opened from Rome through the Near East, across the great deserts and all, to Chang'an, the capital of China at that time. And it branched off in northwest India down into India. There's a back and forth traffic there. And you might say that all the world is sharing one great mythology and philosophy with different local inflections. And now I want to show you a surprise. In the first years of this century, there were a number of German scholars who learned about these roads and decided to go out and explore and see what they would find. There was a beautiful exhibit in the Metropolitan last year of what was found. It's stunning. When the Muslims came in, they cut those routes, and the sands poured over, and the civilization was wiped out. So here's one of the explorers going through the deserts. That's the kind of desert he crossed. Here is his camel train crossing the desert. You know, the Bactrian camels, two humped camels. By the way, camel cigarettes have pictures of a dromedary, an Arabian dromedary, which is a racing camel with one hump. And dromedary dates have pictures of a Bactrian camel. So this is his team of camel men. This is Lop Nor. Look on the map and see where we are. It's nothing but desert, desert, desert. Here is one of the monuments he's going to excavate. They excavate. So what's inside? Some murals. Isn't that a Jewish angel? Definitely. This is a Near Eastern figure. It's a Caucasian person. And the wings, that's a Western idea. The wings represent spiritual flight. But in India, you don't have wings. You have people in spiritual flight. This is Western art, and that's a Western man. There's another. I told you where we were, out in Lop Nor. This gives you an idea of what must have been going on those routes. The Manichaeans, Christians. There is the Buddha, as a Caucasian. The monks, you can see those now in any of these ashrams. This is a Christian mural. Palm Sunday with the palms. So these religions are right together there. And the dates here are B.C. and first 2 centuries A.D. That period. Let's say 2 century B.C., 2 centuries A.D. The mixture back and forth. These centuries, the first 5 or 6 centuries, are the centuries of great Buddhism in Asia. Now, Buddhism came to Tibet rather late, 9th century or so, 8th and 9th centuries. There was a king who had 2 wives. One was Chinese and the other was Indian, and both of them were Buddhists. And he began sending to India 4 teachers, and one after another, very great teachers from the India of those centuries, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th centuries. At this time, Buddhism was in its most elaborate, developed way phase. The Muslims came in starting around 1001 and go across the north of India, smashing. And Buddhism is extinguished in India at that time. See, you could wipe Buddhism out by killing all the monks. But the leaders of Hinduism were the priests and the family men. And Hinduism survived, but Buddhism was extinguished. Well, Buddhism has been extinguished again with the Chinese invasion in 1959. That was the end of it. But in the interval, there was preserved in Tibet, as though in a pickling jar, the Buddhist forms of the highest, most sophisticated tantric developments. And I want to give a sense of that in this afternoon's talk. Now, the mythology of death and birth is a reincarnation. As I've said, I think, already, reincarnation is the counterpart in the Orient of purgatory in the West. That's to say, it's a chance to live again and live out the experiences that should have illuminated you. Purgatory, as I like to say, is a postgraduate course. If you die unilluminated, unready to behold the beatific vision, which would smash everything that you are if you haven't opened, it's there to purge you. And so in the Orient, you come back for another lifetime. Now, the notion is that between the moment of death and the moment of reconception, 49 days pass, 7 times 7 days. And during the course of this, one has gone through all the worlds of the chakras. The chakra system that I introduced this morning is the one that we're going to review today, except in the opposite direction. The notion is that at the moment of death, you experience the great light. Can you stand it? Have you prepared yourself to dissolve? If you can't, there's immediate pullback, protection. That starts you down. Now, the family of the moribund would have sent for a lama, a priest, probably their family chaplain and teacher, to be present. And he will see to it that the person about to die takes the posture of the Buddha for the parinirvana, the lion posture. And then he will have his hand on the jugular vein or some pulse so that he will know at the moment of death that the person has died. And he will then begin to instruct. Now you may ask, what's the point of instructing somebody who's dead about the journey that the soul is about to take? There are two aspects to this. One is, does the person die completely all at once? Is there not a jangling dying of the nerves? The body dies not altogether like that, apparently. The idea is this steadying voice of one who has been one's teacher will help one to survive that jangling moment of disintegration of the spirit so that one will hold to the spirit and know where one is on the way. The other value is that the family is present. And this is a meditation on death. This is a good thing to have happen. You have come in your family life to an immediate and intense experience of one of the great experiences, the experience of death and its meaning, or its sense for your life. And the Lama will consequently be using this as a meditation moment for the family. Not just sitting around talking about how he was in the old days. So at the moment of death, the Lama will say, you are now experiencing the mother light. Between your consciousness and universal consciousness, no obstruction. Try to hold that. You missed it. So you have started at the top. And being unable to hold, you've come down now here. And the Lama will now say, now try to bring into your consciousness the image of the Lord that has been your worship throughout your lifetime. This may be any God. So long as that God has been understood to be the supreme image of the powers of the energizing energies of the universe as they have operated in your lifetime. Maybe a Buddha image of one or another, as we'll see. It may be one of the Hindu gods. It may be some notion of Allah. It may be Yahweh. Any deity that's been your top deity, this is the place to contemplate it. He's second. He's not top. He's second. Then if you can't hold to that, there comes a very interesting series of experiences at this chakra here, the fifth. This is one where there are two stages. One, before your ego has solidified. You are open to the radiance in descending series of those five Buddhas that represent the center and the five directions. And they will be experienced in sequence. First, the Buddha of the center, and then the Buddha of the east, south, west, and north. And if none of these radiances has been able to hold you, but you have been frightened of all, that's because you're still holding too much too tightly to your ego, these same five Buddhas will turn into their what's known as their wrathful aspect, and they'll seem horrific. They'll seem terrifying. They'll be there to smash your ego with terror. If this doesn't work, we come down still another stage. We're still at this chakra here. And there comes what is called the knowledge-holding aspect of these deities. Now, some people are unable to experience radiance, but they can listen to a lecture. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, an American, if he was given a chance to choose between going to heaven and hearing a lecture about heaven, he'd go to the lecture. And so you've been unable to experience heaven, so perhaps you'll take a lecture about it. And maybe that'll save you. Now, up to this, or down to this point, you have been beyond the level of fear of death. That comes at the heart chakra. Then you come into the place of the two triangles, the upward and the downward pointed triangles, the place of decision and choice. This is the critical one. And the Lama will be telling you where you are on the way down and what to hold to and to try to do it. And here you are disintegrating, trying to have this realization that will release you from another birth. And finally we get down to this chakra here. Now come the terrors of death. Before this, death has been the ornament of life, which it is. Life without death in it's no life at all. It's just a fixture. But it's the process of death in you that is life, the burning. And so, up down to here, death has been celebrated. I mean, they'll be saying, kill, kill, kill. Oh, wow, isn't this wonderful? And then down here, it all changes. This is the moment of decision. And I'll tell you what goes on there when we get there. It's a moment of terrific terror. And the Lama will say, do not be afraid. These powers that are tearing you apart and all that, they're just figments of your own imagination. They are, in the field of time, figments. Hold. There's nothing to lose. There's nothing to do. Hold the still point. Still point without moving, you've lost it. And when you lost it, great cliffs close behind you and the upper regions are lost to you. And you're now caught in the descent through the last three chakras. This is the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, which we've come to know. And he is the Bodhisattva of infinite compassion. His compassion reaches to the abyss of hell. There's no being and there's no deed that is beyond the reach of his compassion. And this is the Bodhisattva who is living among us, incarnate in the Dalai Lama. He is regarded as an incarnation of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara of infinite compassion. Now, I've heard the Dalai Lama, when he was over here, give lectures. And his accent, always, in his talk about Buddhism, is on the force of compassion and mercy and love. There are many ways, but this is the way of the Bodhisattva and the way of the tradition that we're now talking about. This is a 17th century Dalai Lama, who is an incarnation of the Bodhisattva, and he sits there with the lotus. The Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara are looking down in mercy at the lotus of the world. This is the Potala, the palace where the Dalai Lama lived. It's on a hill. This is the counterpart of Olympus with the palace of the gods on the top. This is that mythic image of the world axis where heaven and earth come together. And the Bodhisattva represents the incarnation on earth of the quality of divine mercy from heaven. And people in the old days used to take their walks, their daily walk. They weren't jogging in those days, but they'd take a walk around the palace in the clockwise direction, circumambulation. And they'd take with them their pet lambs and dogs so that they too could build up merit by circumambulating. Because it's the one life that inhabits the whole world. That's such a lovely thing. The animals are our little fellows coming along, and they'll be up there later. This is true of the trees and the grass and even the rocks. Well, that's now finished. It's a museum, I'm told. I've already discussed this. These are the five meditation Buddhas whom we're going to encounter here at the throat. The one of the center, the east, the south, the west, and the north. The Buddha at the immovable spot, illumination, the pig of ignorance slain, and the teaching communicated to the disciples. The person is about to die. The Dalai Lama has, not the Dalai, the local Lama has his hand on the pulse. And at the moment of death, he says, "You are now beholding the Mother Light." Now that is absolute Brahman. That's undifferentiated consciousness. That's what we're intending all the way here. You may speak of it as the void. You may speak of it as the abyss. You may speak of it as Mother Light. It is that which transcends all cogitations. There are no words for it. So he would say, hold it. Well, if you can't, you're slipping down now from chakra 7 to 6, and he asks you to bring to consciousness the image of the Lord that you have chosen for your life contemplation. Now, this is a beautiful figure. This is Mahavairochana, the great Sun Buddha. In Japanese, Dainichi Nyorai. Great day, just come. The five meditation Buddhas are in his tiara here. Now, when I was doing a book, which is here on the table, The Mythic Image, I have a picture of this Buddha. And I wanted to write something about it. And I thought, well, who am I to write about Dainichi Nyorai? Dante has already done it. So I turned to the last canto of the Divine Comedy of Paradiso, and there it was. The appearance of the Trinity, here in one form but with five aspects instead of three aspects. One divine substance, three divine personalities representing, you know, the power, the consciousness, and the rapture of the divine, seated or appearing in the heavenly rose, lotus, where the rose is. And Dante said, as I was beholding the Trinity, the personification of the mystery, there appeared behind them three rings of light. One, two, three rings of light. So I used that as my text to this picture. In Finnegan's Wake, Joyce has the cycle. The book begins with the second half of a sentence with which the book ends. Away, a last alone, a loved along the river run past even Adams from Swerve Shore to Bender Bay brings us by commodious vehicles of recirculation back to Holt Castle and the environs. Well, you can quit here. Away, a last, a loved alone, along the. I finished with the book. I'm out. Or, see, I enjoyed that book. I'd like to do it again. You see, you're back. It's reincarnation. So we're here now with whatever the Buddha is, and we're going to descend to the throat chakra, and one of these will appear, and they'll appear in sequence, as the bliss bestowing, such bliss as you're afraid to accept. Now here's a representation of Vairochana. Mahavairochana, Vairochana, Sun Buddha. The other was Great Sun Buddha, seated in meditation, doing nothing. Here is the Buddha in teaching posture, representing doing something to help you. You haven't got there. You haven't reached the top, but you're pretty close. And a word of instruction may do it for you. So this is this figure. And then we're going to follow these Akshobhya, Ratnasambhava, Amida, and then Amoghasiddhi. And this east, south, west, and north. Now we come to Akshobhya. The word Akshobhya means can't be pushed around, can't be moved. He's at the immovable spot. He has illumination, and the tempter cannot move him. In his hand, he will have the thunderbolt, and you'll see his Shakti. This is the turning about of the Shakti, is addressed to him. Now, the quality here is tenacity. The negative aspect of tenacity is stubbornness. Now, if your virtue is stubbornness, hold it. Don't lose it. This is one of the problems of renovating your character. Do you remember the play Equus? The problem, the psychological problem there, which the psychologist realized, was what have I done when I have deprived a man of his God? I think it's Nietzsche who says somewhere, be careful lest in casting out your devil, you cast out the best thing that's in you. And so many people who have been psychoanalyzed are like filleted fish. The character is gone. If you're nasty, be nasty. But the energy, the Shakti, is to be turned around. This is known as the turning about of the Shakti. The stubbornness, if that is all you've got and you haven't turned it around, you will be reborn in the realm of the stubborn, and that's hell. Hell is the place of people who are stubborn about their individuations and what those individuations mean to them and their personalities and their wishes and notions of good and evil and so forth. So this is your virtue and this is your vice. This is Fudo. This is Akshobhya in the aspect of immovable in fire. This is a Japanese representation. Remember the Vietnam monk that had himself set fire? A picture in the New York Times was a picture of Fudo. There he was seated, immovable in fire with the flames going up. Of course, if he had moved, he would have lost merit. I mean, the whole thing was that he had so transcended the body that he could do a thing like that. It's impudence to do that when you can't do that. And here is holding on to the thunderbolt of illumination. If you are responding to Vairochana's teaching and you are still to be reborn, you will be reborn in a heaven. If you're stuck with your stubbornness, you'll be reborn in hell. There he sits, earth-touching posture. The Buddha at that moment where life is speaking to him in its loudest voice, and he is deaf to it, he's going to the Father, the crucifixion. And now we go to the south. This is the most charming of these Buddhas. His name is Ratnasambhava, born of a jewel. His quality is beauty. And what's the vice? Pride. Now, if your pride is in your beauty, hold to it. But turn it about so that the beauty that you're proud of is your spiritual beauty. And then you will cultivate that. Do not get rid of your vice. If it's pride, make the pride work to your illumination, not to your degradation. That's all there is to this. So if you're reborn under the sign of this deity, you will have a human rebirth. Now we've got three of the realms of rebirth: the heaven, the hell, and the human rebirth. Lord of the South. Notice the beauty of the attitude. Boon bestowing, generosity. The proud and the beautiful are generous. This is the favorite Buddha of the East. This is Amida, Sanskrit Amitabha. Amita means immeasurable, bha is radiance. The Buddha of immeasurable radiance. Now, there's a legend associated with his name. When he was on the very threshold of illumination, he made a vow. He said, I will not accept illumination for myself unless through my illumination I can bring to illumination and release all beings who pay me worship, who honor my name. And so when he achieved illumination, there broke out before him a great lake. And it was a lake of bliss. And on this lake were lotuses. And anyone who during his lifetime had either greatly or in a less great way paid devotion to Amida would not be committed to another lifetime, but would be reborn on a lotus in Amida's lotus pond called Sukhavati, the place of bliss. If the person was not even nearly illuminated, his lotus would be closed, and he'd be in a closed lotus. And he'd be floating on this lake, which would be a water of the five colors, of the five elements. And as the waters rippled, he would hear, all is impermanent. All is without a self. All is impermanent. All is without a self. And around the countryside would be, around the lake, would be these jewel trees with jewel birds singing, and they would be singing, all is impermanent. All is without a self. And musical instruments in the air would be playing, all is impermanent. All is without a self. Presently, he'd get the message. Meanwhile, the radiance of the Buddha himself, like a setting sun on the western horizon, would be penetrating the petals, and they would open. And there he would be sitting as a Buddha in meditation, floating on the lotus pond. And presently, in his meditation, he would dissolve into rapture and transcendence. Now, the quality of this Buddha is mercy, compassion. This is the Buddha whose lieutenant is Avalokiteshvara and whose incarnation on earth then is in the Dalai Lama. The quality is compassion. And what do you suppose the vice would be? Attachment. Attachment to that being for whom you feel love. And if you die with that attachment, you will be reborn in the world of the hungry ghosts. The hungry ghosts have ravenous bellies and pinpoint mouths. They can never be fed what they desire. And now we come to the fourth of the surrounding Buddha's, the one of the north. That's the ominous direction. His name is Amoghasiddhi, he who will not be turned from the achievement of his aim. Siddhi is the aim, achievement, Amogha, not to be distracted from it. And you see what's happened is, as we've come down, we've lost, as it were, the Vajra. In the first Akshobhya, there was the Vajra in his hand. And now we're in quest of the Vajra. So there's a descending series here. The virtue here is tenacity of purpose, not just holding to where you are, but but in intention. And the negative aspect is belligerence. And if you die in this context, you will be reborn in the realm of the anti-gods, the demons, the fighting gods. And there he sits. Don't be afraid. And here's another fine picture of him with the double vajra in his hand. This is a great Tibetan representation of the vajra with the yang yin in the center. You get a Chinese and Hindu combination here. Now we're going to descend one step to the realm of the knowledge-holding deities. They're having a ball. I always think of it as a kind of college prom. And they're shouting, death, death, death. And they're waving banners that are made of flayed human skins. They're blowing trumpets made of thigh bones of human beings and so forth. Death is the ornament of life. They're not afraid of death. And they're right on the edge, still experiencing the excitement of dying and so forth. This is the way they look. This is the mandala. It's a terrific affair. These are the gods that were formerly the benevolent. Varachana, Akshobhya, and so forth and so on. Now, this is one of the people they're dancing with. This is known as a Dakini. That's a space fairy. I once saw on 42nd Street an advertisement for a movie, you know, Fire Women of Outer Space. That's what we've got here. And in this hand is a flaying knife with a thunderbolt handle. Here is a staff with heads on it and thunderbolt, necklace of skulls, and so forth and so on. This is the kind that you meet at these parties. This is the lion-headed Dakini, Singha Dakini, trampling the mere animal nature. In fact, every time one does accept a partner like that, one has trampled on one's own animal nature. Compassion has taken over. This is the great one, Sarva Buddha Dakini, the Dakini or fairy goddess of all the Buddhas. And what is she drinking from? That's the top of a skull. And what is she drinking? Blood. And she's wearing this kilt here made of human bones carved. And there is the thunderbolt flaying knife, and so forth and so on. These are the partners in this dance. You're dancing in partnership with Lady Death. And you don't mind. Here is the inspiration for many of these images. This is Kali, the Hindu goddess of the same power, drinking from a skull. This has been taken over in the Buddhist system by these Dakinis. Now, here is a skull with a nice silver border. And here is such a symbolic flaying knife. Kilt of human bones that have been carved. Symbolic images. Human thigh bones used for trumpets. And here is a monk blowing such a trumpet. Here in one of the monasteries around Delhi, we have this dance of the monks as skeletons around what is pretended to be a dead body. Here is a crown of five silver skulls. I mean, death is being celebrated at this stage. And then lower than that come the deities in their ferocious aspects, the wrathful aspects of the deities, and it's described. And the lama at the bedside will be saying, the deities will be coming to you, every hair of the head radiant with fire, and they'll be making strange sounds, clack, 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 and so forth and so forth, terrifying, terrifying, do not be terrified. These are but the violent aspects of your own consciousness, is one of them. It's another one of them. Ravana, the Lord Death. Another, the whole being is just terror and fright. And the Lama will be saying, do not be terrified, do not move. This is the second temptation of the Buddha, temptation of fear and terror. Be calm. Now, this is what is known as Yamantaka, that aspect of the powers that kills in you the fear of death. Yama is the lord of death, the first man who died. And antaka means end, the ender of the fear of death, ender of the lord death. And he is surrounded here by various powers. This is a female figure who is a convert to Buddhism. And she goes out to convert everybody else. You know how converts are. And a little bit insecure, and they want to reassure themselves by converting everybody else. And people who would not submit, she flayed. Her name is Lamo, L-H-A-M-O. The first person she could not convert and so slayed was her own son. Here's a representation of her in such a fury that you can't even see her. But this peacock feathered parasol is her sign. And here are flayed creatures that she has. It's trying to give you the sense of the violent aspect of the power to break the ego. And here is Vajratara, the thunderbolt holder. And the door got in with a flaying knife as the crown of his tiara and the bowl of a skull as his drinking vessel. We've come down now from the top chakra through the sixth. We've come down to chakra five here. The syllable is hung. And now we're coming down to the fourth chakra where the syllable is yang. At the level of the heart, and you see the two triangles. This is the place of decision. If you don't sign out here, you're going to come down the rest of the way. It's the place of the moon. The moon is both body and light, and so are you below this level. Now, are you going to identify with the body, the vehicle, or are you going to identify with the light? The Lama will be saying, you have come to the realm of the Lord Death, the judge of the dead. See the lunar horns, the monster buffalo face. And his minions will come at you, and they'll tear you apart. Here is a tanka representing this. Here's the Lord Death. Here are people being judged, and we look at them step by step. Here is the hell torches. All of this now is what's come upon you. Here are the weighing scales where good deeds are weighed against bad deeds. And then people are assigned to the different worlds. And if you die caught up in the dance instead of in its significance, you will be reborn as an animal. Now, my wife Jean had a studio on Fifth Avenue. Dance studio on the second floor. And on the first floor was a pet shop. And this was the lesson. If in your dancing, all you're thinking about are your muscles, you're going to be reborn as an animal. There's no doubt about that. But there were pipes coming up from below, and mice used to climb up there, and those are aspirants to the next stage. Here now are people with their lives being weighed, and here are those waiting to be weighed, and they certainly look anxious about it. But then comes the hell scenes. These are the ones that tear you apart. And you see people being chopped to pieces, people being dragged to hell. This is the place of a freezing hell. Here they're broiling. Now this, my dear friends, is a book. And these are monks who skipped passages in their prayers. More horrific scenes. This fellow with a heavy rock on his back is a person who likes to kill insects. Do not be afraid. Now, I thought when I was reading, as I did in 1960, of some of the affairs that had occurred in Tibet in 1959 when the monks were being tortured. And they could torture a man for 7 days without killing him and being torn apart. And I thought of what the monk here would be saying to the person dying with these subtle terrors. Now we have the gross terrors of an actual torture scene. thousands of monks killed. Just as when the Muslims came into North India, thousands of monks killed. Those monasteries around Lhasa had 6,000-8,000 monks that wiped out. And I thought, if the monk there, having all this happen, could think nothing is happening, it's merely the field of time, the still point is here, he would achieve illumination. It was Halaj, the great Sufi mystic, and this is reported of him, that when he was about to be crucified and tortured as Jesus was, he uttered a prayer. And the prayer is said to have been, O Lord, if you had revealed to them what you have revealed to me, they would not be doing this to me. If you had not revealed to me what you have, this would not be happening to me. O Lord, praise to thee in thy works. That's big stuff. And then Halaj is reported to have said, the function of the Orthodox community is to give the mystic his desire. So that's a good way to think about it. It's a heroic way to think about it. This is the final picture then of the Lord, judge of the dead, the bull with the moon horns and the terrors and all. And if we can get past that, we are released. If we can't, there closes behind us a great cliff, and the sublime is no longer ours. And we're going to hear noises, and those are the noises of the world. And when we hear these noises, try sometimes not to think of what is being said, but of what is talking. And what is talking is ignorance, lust, and malice. And this is the hub of the world as it's experienced by people who are still in fear of the Lord death. The world as we experience it is a world of the first three chakras: ignorance, lust, and malice. Reincarnation, souls going up, souls going down, round and round and round. And the boundaries of our world is this rim here with 12 what are called mutually arising causes. This is the boundary beyond which we do not see because we are in fear of the Lord death. Now this mandala is never on the inside of a monastery, it's on the outside, on the outside wall. And so we've slipped. We're on the last three chakras now. At this here, chakra 3, you begin to see couples embracing. And the Lama at his side will be saying, try not to get between them. So we've come to the level of Dr. Freud. Below that, we have got between them. We're going to get born. And we will be born either as male or as female. And if we're to be born as male, we will find ourselves hating our father and loving our mother. If it's going to be female, it'll be the other way around, the Oedipus and the Electra complexes. And so the final job of the Lama is to get you born in a decent environment where you'll have a chance to receive Buddhist instructions for another lifetime and to save you from birth, let's say, in the egg of a flea or the womb of a mouse or something like that. All of these are possibilities. And then one is born, this frightened, little, terrified thing who's just had a great fight through the birth canal, and his eyes open to the surfaces of things, and he has been through the whole inward mystery and has forgotten it. And Plato in the Timaeus says the only thing one can do for another is reintroduce him to those forms of the spirit, the memory of which was lost at birth. And so we're in the same club there. Now this is a mandala that was made by one of Jung's patients. And you have the six worlds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In the middle, she is shown reading, undoubtedly reading Jung. This is Pancharaksha, the patroness of books, of coming to illumination through reading scripture. This is the same mandala that we've seen with ignorance and malice and lust in the center. When you have been led by scripture not to fear death anymore, that world, which seems such a horror, is transformed into a world of Buddha consciousness. Buddha everywhere. And it's through scripture that one has been led to this. Now this figure, this Pancharaksha, is called a Yidam. The Sanskrit is chosen deity. The Yidam is the a deity that you yourself have chosen. Ishtadeva, or Ishtadevata, the wished for deity. This is a very sophisticated idea. This deity has no existence. It's a picture. It's to put in your mind the idea of a deity. And it will achieve life insofar as you make this your deity. And then this deity, the deity of reading and scripture, becomes the guide of your life. Now, I speak of this first because it happens to be mine. Everything I know, I've gotten from reading. And when I meet Buddhas and yogis and whatnot, I interpret them in terms of my reading. I put this right on the face of the Buddha himself. And this is what holds you. Other people will have other Ishtadevatas, other chosen deities. But stick to your chosen deity. It's your way. And the whole Buddha world will come to your knowledge through whatever your deity is. This is Kala Chakra, another Ishtadevata or Yidam. Kala Chakra means the wheel of time. Everything is Buddha. And this is the world which, when you're in fear of death, is such a horrible place. No horror can survive the radiance of these knowledges that come. This is Chakrasamvara Raja, the all-embracing Lord, and that's his mandala. Now, I had a very interesting experience about this. I have a tanka. We have a tanka hanging in our foyer in our apartment. It's this one. And I was helping a Tibetan monk to write his autobiography. And as he walked out of our apartment, he saw this thing in front of him. And he said, "Why, that's the Ishtadevata, the Yidam of my monastery." And so it can be not simply a personal choice, but the whole monastery. That is the power that is informing the exercises of that specific monastery. I call these the most sophisticated notions of deity anywhere that I know. The notion of a chosen deity that's going to be your guide. And so we come now to the conclusion of this story, how the Lord, with his Shakti turned about, comes to transcendence, each of us, soul. And here's the final one, the Buddha, immovable, teaching the world.